Aloha, it's Tuesday, September 17th, and this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. We hear more from management at Hawaii Pacific Health about the lockout of some 600 nurses as negotiators prepare to head back to the bargaining table. And $10 billion worth of construction projects forecast to be in the pipeline across the state, but we need to grow the pool of workers to sustain the effort that is fueling our economy. There's a new report out about this. Today kicks off a convention on the Big Island. The Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement brings people together to celebrate all things around the island of Hawaii. And a town hall meeting on Oahu's west side last night brought together a community reeling over the recent violence. We hear from residents about their changing neighborhoods. And a call for peace, we highlight a dance concert opening this Friday. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Hundreds of nurses who have been locked out of their jobs at Kapi'olani Medical Center for Women and Children marched from the state capitol to the downtown offices of Hawaii Pacific Health this morning. The demonstration and rally took place starting at 8 a.m. and it's just wrapping up at Harbor Court. This morning we talked to Gidget Ruschetta. She's the COO, the Chief Operating Officer of Kapi'olani Hospital, and she was there at her office on Punahou. She says there are no nurses gathered at the facility and it's business as usual with ambulances pulling in and out of the emergency room.
Kapi'olani remains fully staffed and our hospital is running as it always has. In the first 3 days that the temporary workforce has been in place, we've delivered 45 babies, we've received 11 ambulance patients, and we've performed 30 surgical procedures. And this is the time of the year when the most babies are born at the medical center. And we have our temporary workforce in place serving our patients. And more than 75% of our temporary workforce has been assigned to Kapi'olani before, so they are familiar with our facility and our workflows here.
Well, the nurses union raised some concerns about staffing and the departure of some key nurses. I believe it was in the NICU. What can you say about that?
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to clarify something that was said yesterday during your show. The union has claimed that 15 nurses had left Kapi'olani, the NICU, in a single month, and that's simply not true. The number of nurses is approximately a little over 8 in the month. So over the last 8 months, we've had very few that have been departing in a department that we have more than 150 nurses that work in. To be clear, that some of these nurses that have left for other opportunities at Kapi'olani or throughout our system.
So it wasn't a departure of nurses in a month, it was over a period
over
of time?
Over 8 months, yes. And that's an approximation over the 8 month period.
And then how are we doing in the neonatal intensive care unit at this point? How are we staffed with the traveling nurses?
These are highly skilled, experienced nurses that have worked at some of the top children's hospitals in the nation. Rady Children's, Texas Children's, MD Anderson Children for cancer. And as our community expects us, we continue to maintain our programs and services at the highest level.
And, you know, there is a community concern about the use of a lockout. Can you talk about what led up to this?
This was a very difficult decision, and it was not an action we wanted to take. Our nurses are an integral part of our care team, and some have worked alongside our physicians, our pharmacists, and other Kapi'olani employees for decades. In healthcare, our staff are so closely integrated in what they do with patients that they become dear friends. And that is why it was so hard for everyone when we ran out of options. We needed to reach an agreement so so we can move forward. And remember, we spent more than a year negotiating with H&A, and in that year, we had over 30 negotiating sessions. Both sides agreed to have a federal mediator, and H&A has now called two strikes. And Friday was a one-day strike. H&A could have also called another strike any time with a 10-day notice. And intermittent strikes are far too disruptive for our patients who depend on us. You know, a done deal is the only resolution. And we cannot leave anything more to chance because it's gone on long enough. And we cannot allow a labor dispute to jeopardize our ability to serve critical health care needs. And for all these reasons, we need to reach an agreement. This lockout is to get an agreement. And to put it into context for people to understand, Kapiolani is not like other businesses. We can't close because of a labor dispute. We have to be here for our patients and our community. And a good example of that are babies. Babies are not born on a schedule. They come when they want to come.
That's true.
And we have to be here for their families. You know, there's no negotiating what patients deserve from us. And we have committed to this community for over 130 years that we would be here. Our doors would never close. We're open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we treasure that commitment. That's who we are at Kapiolani.
We understand that the Hawaii Nurses Union has offered to meet on Thursday. Is that still the plan?
We have accepted the union's request to meet this Thursday, and we've also requested to reengage the federal mediator, but the union has declined it. And our nurses deserve a new contract. We want them back at the bedside, serving our patients, because we know that's what they want to be doing. And it's important to know that the negotiating team for Hawaii Pacific Health, for Kapiolani specifically, is made up of nurses mostly.
Well, you know, we are hearing all the ambulances in the background. I mean, you're there at the hospital and you've got the ER, and you just never know when you're going to get a patient arriving on
Yes.
your doorstep.
You know, that makes it even more important for us to come to resolution for this contract for our nurses to get back to work in the medical center for our patients, is because you never know what's going to happen at Kapiolani. We're delivering babies. You've got kids coming in through the emergency room. You've got surgeries. This is a medical center that never goes to sleep.
There have been calls for the governor to help bring the two sides together. We understand that legally, you know, he cannot at this point. And we understand when the federal mediator, at least we were told when the federal mediator was brought in earlier, he said, you folks are too far apart.
I can't really speak to what the governor is sharing. What I can tell you is that we are committed to reaching an agreement for our nurses. They deserve a new contract, and we want to see that happen for them. And we are committed to negotiate with the union as long as it takes in order to get a new contract in place for them so that they can benefit from the offer we have on the table.
And you initially had said that you would continue to lock out the nurses until they unconditionally accepted your offer, but going back to the table then Thursday, you're giving at this point.
We have always been wanting to come back to the table. For example, last week we met twice, and we are still incorporating the priorities that our nurses have brought to the table and are expressing. This is a dynamic process, and we are committed to reaching an agreement. Unconditionally means that when we resolve this, we resolve it in completion. So we want to complete the process. But coming back to the table means we are committed, we are listening, and we are incorporating into our offer. So we want to be back at the table Thursday. We want to have good dialogue with the union, and we want to reach an agreement for our nurses.
Okay, and that is in person?
Yes.
All right, okay. Have they set a location for that?
I know that they are still working on all the details, so, you know, they will let me know when it's all finalized, but that is in process right
okay.
now.
Okay. All right, anything else?
What I would say is that we're going to the table to negotiate on Thursday. As always, we're focused on reaching an agreement, and it's what we want, and it's what our nurses want, and it's what our community wants. And it's time to resolve this and move forward.
That was Gidget Rosetta, COO of Kapiolani Medical Center, which operates the NICU, a neonatal intensive care unit. Negotiators for management and the nurses union are scheduled to go back face-to-face with face-to-face talks on Thursday. Full disclosure, Hawaii Pacific Health is an HPR underwriter.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Occupational Safety and Health, also known as HIOSH, committed to the people of Hawaii, working to help keep workplaces safe and protect employees' rights. More by searching HIOSH.
The news and music you hear on HPR are supported in part by nearly 200 local organizations that choose to reinforce their brand with us. Mahalo to the Maui Ocean Center, Evergreen by Deborah, and Hammock. They believe, just as you do, in the power of public radio. See a full list of our underwriters at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Outrigger Resorts and Hotels, featuring the sights and sounds of beaches throughout the islands, live music, and cultural experiences. Learn more at outrigger.com.
There's a new report out about the state of our construction industry this morning. It's titled New Foundations, Laying the Groundwork for Hawaii's Middle Class Renewal and Revival of the Trades. Josh Magno is the intern director of the Pacific Resource Partnership affiliated with the Carpenters Union, which is behind the development report. The construction industry is expected to generate about $10 billion for our economy over the next 3 to 4 years. So how do we ramp up our workforce when our population is aging out? PRP calls it the Great Crew Change.
Well, I think right now, you know, we're in the throes of a very healthy upcycle, and we have been for the last 10 plus years now. So it's been a really prolonged upturn for us, which we're, you know, very fortunate, greatly appreciative. However, you know, that does put some strain on our labor and workforce, like many other industries, you know, so it's really become a top of mind issue for us in developing the next generation of workers that can help supply our contractors here in the state.
Well, yeah, so while we are fortunate to have the construction leg of the tripod holding us up, you know, because tourism is not
sure.
quite rebounded to pre-pandemic days.
Sure.
But we do have local construction happening. We've got large military contracts out at the shipyard, you know, all this building for affordable housing, but we need mm-hmm. the workforce, a trained workforce.
Correct. Yeah. And, you know, it's what we're also facing, again, like every other industry in this state, is the silver tsunami, you know, and we're calling it our great crew change. And as folks retire out of the trades, it's more important for us to fill that pipeline of workers with young, energetic, both men and women who are interested in the industry.
To that end, we have this big event that's happening over there at the stadium parking lot mm-hmm. to introduce young people in our, what, junior and high school level?
Yes. So later this week, we have about 1,400 students from all over the state coming to Halawa, in the hopes of just kind of, you know, seeing what the industry is really all about and getting their hands dirty a little bit on jumping on machines, working with some of the equipment, so that they get a sense of what it's like to be part of the construction industry.
Well, and you have so many different trades that are involved when you put up a high rise. What's the blueprint? What's the roadmap?
And really, it starts with the kids and reaching down into the schools and through our through the Hawaii Carpenters Apprenticeship and Training Fund. The executive director, Edmund Axon, is actually putting together programs. We're also talking to middle schoolers now. And so getting these kids early on within their educational career exposed to what it takes to be part of the construction industry, giving them really hands-on practical experiences through internships, through pre-apprenticeship programs. So they get a sense of, before going into the and fully committing to the trade, what it takes to become a very successful tradesperson.
You know, these jobs, I mean, once you have these skills, whether, you know, you get into an apprenticeship program, they're pretty well paid.
Absolutely. You know, our biggest selling point is that through the Hawaii Carpenters Apprenticeship Training Fund, it's a four-year program, apprenticeship program, where at the end of 4 years, you know, you potentially can become a journey person. And with that comes, you know, a potential living wage, a salary of, you know, over six figures. And so that's really enticing for folks that are coming straight out of high school, no college debt, but looking to really learn some lifelong skills that they can put to use, not in, just in their professional lives, but also in their personal lives as well.
Are we doing anything different this year, you know, besides just reaching into the lower grades?
You know, that's a big part of it. I think getting these students exposed to, you know, really what it takes, the hard work, being able to, you know, the physical exertion required of the industry. But we're also doing some interesting things through the Hawaii Carpenters Union and working. We developed this mentorship program where we have seasoned journey level workers who take new apprentices under their wings and kind of show them the ropes. What we found is that, you know, the more that we can provide sort of an encouraging, supportive environment, the more likely these apprentices will stick around despite the hard work, despite working out in the sun. I think if they have that teamwork mentality there on the job site, they're more likely to stick it out and become journeymen in the long run.
And you mentioned that you often take this career day program out to the neighbor islands.
Yes, you know, it's, you know, the work is required from all the counties throughout the state, you know, especially looking at Maui and the rebuild of Lahaina. We're going to need even more workers out there to help with not just the rebuild of Lahaina, but before the wildfires, you know, Maui was already housing constrained and there wasn't enough homes being built there. So there's a great demand for workers throughout all the neighbor islands as well.
What's probably the biggest barrier, you think, in growing our workforce?
I think really part of it is perception, and part of it that it's, quite frankly, just hard work. You know, you're not going to be sitting in an office, an air-conditioned office behind a desk all day. You're going to be outside getting dirty, working with your hands. And so, you know, for a lot of these kids looking at this industry, it's a pretty drastic realization that you're going to be working hard, you're going to be running all day. And so that's why it's really important for us to have these programs early on that expose these kids to the hard work, the physicality of the work, so that, you know, if they know this is a path for them, they understand what it takes and what it's going to get them to be successful in the long run.
And there's something to be said, though, about working kind of shoulder to shoulder with folks and helping to bring something from the ground up, you know, that you have this sense of pride when they do
Absolutely.
A topping off at a high rise.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, that's such a great point, Catherine. A lot of trades people that we've talked to, even retirees, you know, they can remember what project they worked on during their apprenticeship program. They can point to these buildings, public facilities throughout the state and say, I worked on that. And so there's this tremendous sense of pride that our folks have throughout the industry, whether they be in the field or working through some of the white collar positions, and that you've been a part of, you know, Hawaii's history in that sense.
And then do you have programs that work with maybe the migrant communities that come through here?
Not directly. You know, I think from the union standpoint, we're able to recruit anyone that's sort of willing to work here, you know, really roll up their sleeves, get their hands dirty. We have year-round recruitment, you know, that's happening right now that I think is very supportive of anyone looking to come in. We're also engaged with some of the federal detention facilities, OCCC. We have programs that reach into the women's prison programs. And so we're, you know, looking at different avenues where we can attract, recruit, and retain and upskill a lot of these workers from varying demographics.
And I imagine, too, if someone is willing to give it a go and maybe switch careers, if you've sat in an office before and want to get out, and build something with your hands, that maybe you have that opportunity?
Absolutely. You know, I think the union and our apprenticeship training fund, they don't discriminate as long as you have the right work ethic, values, and are willing to learn and open to direction. I think, you know, doors are open for anyone looking to switch careers.
And so give us an example, if there are any folks out there, any of our listeners who might have, let's say, children or grandchildren that they think might have a skill in building or to get in the trades. Like, what does an average carpenter make?
Sure. I think if you're looking at, you know, a journey person who's gone through 4 years of the apprenticeship program and is working full-time, they can make upwards of $100,000, you know, assuming they work full-time for 52 weeks out of the year. And so the apprenticeship obviously is a percentage of that wage rate. But that's sort of, you know, the carrot for a lot of folks that are looking to come in, learn a new skill, and be able to earn a living wage through construction.
So six-figure salaries are a possibility.
As well as, you know, full health and welfare benefits, full medical, retire, vacation. So you name it, and the industry provides a lot of that benefits, health and work, medical, again, for the workers and their families.
Anything else you want to underscore?
One of the other programs that I may have forgotten to mention to you, Catherine, is the Sisters in Brotherhood program, and being more deliberate and intentional about recruiting females into the industry. And we have a growing program at the Carpenters Union where, you know, we are organizing female apprentices coming through the industry and giving them leadership opportunities where appropriate. And so, you know, that's an exciting program for us, is attracting females into construction, carpentry.
Yeah, we have done stories with, I think there's programs, Mana Wahine, and, you know, whether it's folks working up, running the cranes,
yeah,
you know, getting women up in those jobs up
yeah.
high there, or working up a forklift, or out there picking up a hammer.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that was PRP's Josh Magno talking about a new report about workforce development that was just released today. It comes as some 1,400 students are taking part in a career day at the Aloha Stadium lower level parking lot on Thursday and Friday from 8 to 1:30. Look for links to the report on our website later today.
Classical music on HPR2 illuminates and inspires music lovers of all ages. A recent survey revealed that while our most loyal HPR2 listeners are over the age of 60, nearly half of our occasional listeners are under 30. Your monthly donation to HPR helps ensure that Hawaii's only broadcast source for classical music is here to stay. Donate today at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Vegas, Los Angeles, Maui, and now the island of Hawaii. Why the Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement is turning the spotlight on the Big Island. Its convention kicks off today at the Hilton Waikoloa Resort. CEO Kuhio Lewis dropped by our studios on Friday to talk about what's in store this week.
I don't like to do the same thing every time. I just think it's exciting to try something different. And so moving it around, the convention around to different islands, whether it's Las Vegas, whether it's Maui, whether it's Hawaii Island, I think it allows people to engage that wouldn't otherwise engage. But it also gives us a chance to highlight that destination. So the theme of the convention is Experience Hawaii Island. And so we are bringing all that Hawaii Island has to offer into this space, whether it's a fashion show, because it's a hub for all these huge fashion designers. You know, there's even models of tourism that we can learn from Hawaii Island. So tourism's factored in there. You have discussions of hot topics, Mauna Kea, the military leases. These are things that I think are important, not just for Hawaii Island, but for the rest of the state, because what happens there could set the tone for what might happen in Waimea Valley or other areas that, you know, perhaps the military leases are also expiring there. What could happen there? So, yeah, it's exciting, and we want to keep it exciting so people are engaged. This is a different audience. They follow things differently. Trying to do the same thing is just not going to keep them captivated, and we need them to be part of the discussion.
Well, you know, about a year or so ago, I was doing some stories down there at the Natural Energy Lab and was pleasantly surprised at the experience. The salt company down there, you know, employed a Native Hawaiian from Molokai talking about Pa'akai, and the stories and the culture around that. And so I went away with a really good feeling. Like, gosh, you know, if somebody from Iowa were to come here, you would just get a deeper appreciation for Hawaii.
Yeah. You know, in some ways too, Catherine, people of Hawaii, I don't even think understand like the richness of where they're from, where they come from. And so educate, like I think sometimes visitors actually know more about our places or are educated about our places than even us. So this is a chance for us to learn intimately about our place so we can be better hosts for visitors or even to future generations.
Yeah, and a sake maker over there at Mauna Kea was talking about paniolos, you know, and how they used to make sake, you know, back in the day. So it was just this really rich history that you don't hear about, but boy, it was really interesting to learn.
Yep. You know, the paniolos is a good example, right? I mean, we literally had cowboys in Waimea before even the West had cowboys, you know, and that was because Kalakaua, he would go around and he'd recruit different ethnic groups to come and learn from them. And we got paniolo here. So we've had cowboys here even before the West became a thing.
And what I love is that our young people are competing at these rodeos and are showing off their skills and are winning prizes.
All
it's amazing.
All over America, yes.
Yeah. So really then this convention is meant to draw in people that maybe wouldn't have come before? Or
yeah. It's designed to be enriching for the people of Hawaii, the people outside of Hawaii. And I would say very strongly that it's not just for Hawaiians. It's a chance for us to work with all ethnic people, learn about Hawaii, experience our culture. That, to me, is the real meaning of having a convention, a convening. And it's a chance for all of these ethnic groups to just thrive in our home.
You mentioned fashion, and of course, Manaola, you know, has taken the industry to a different level as Micah.
Yep, Kamaholi'i.
Yes, and it's just really so nice to see.
Yeah. Hawaii Island is rich in history, very talented in the culture and arts arena. It is the home of Mary Monarch. You know, like, so there's all of these things. And, you know, as you think about it, Catherine, I think when you look at like Hilo, for example, there is so much opportunity to innovate there. You know, like you have Banyan Drive. And I just think there's so much potential just looking at what exists in terms of the stories, in terms of the cultural aspects, all could be incorporated into a destination that is authentic. So I think there's a real future on Hawaii Island in which the people can help curate. And with us holding a contract with HTA, I think that is something that we'd be very interested in, helping the state to create a destination in Hilo that is worthy of a regenerative model and something that I think both visitors and residents can be super proud of.
Well, and I think, too, of when those soccer fields flood, you know, and I know that's the idea, right? You've got to be able to be resilient and understand how things are changing and whether it's rising sea levels or threats of invasive species. It's like, how can we turn this around? How can we be on the cutting edge and come up with creative solutions and lead the way and be a model?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, if you think about it, I hate to say this, but Oahu, even Maui to agree, it's so entrenched in politics. It's, you know, it's, but if you look at Hilo, I actually see a future there where there's the land, the prices are still stable, you know, the home prices, there's still a lot of land left. The politics is not as bad. I mean, maybe we could focus on that as a future. And then perhaps the other counties or districts could say, wow, look at what they're doing there, and actually might follow course. So my point in saying that is I really think Hawaii Island could be somewhere that could lead the rest of the state if we work together and build up that place correctly. And, you know, CNHA just acquired 43 acres in Hilo, too. So we're looking at building there. We're looking at developing there, but doing it in a way that's right. So building out workforce housing, whether it's affordable housing. So we purchased land right outside of Hilo in Kaumana, which is just a few minutes out of the town. So we're starting to move some of our assets to Hawaii Island because of that future that I see.
So that could be another magnet to grow.
I think so. I mean, I'm kind of excited about our trajectory on Hawaii Island. And I think it's in part deliberate that we're moving our convention there towards that end. Like, we plan to focus and see how we can support, uplift that community.
And then how do you see bridging the two sides together? Because they're very different siblings, you know, Kona and in Hilo.
Yeah, that's always tricky. But I think Kona has become another tourism destination, I would say. It's growing very quickly. I think Hilo still has this authenticness about it. And so I think, you know, if we're trying to create models here of what a destination could look like, or even a home could look like, I think there's a lot of hope in Hilo. Kona too, you know, Kona has a lot of, I think, opportunity still to strengthen it, its core. It's already kind of running away from us because of the commercialization of a lot of things. But I don't think it's run completely away. I think there's still a lot of hope there. But they're unique destinations. Each of them have their own character. They have their own stories. And Big Island is made up of 6 different mokus or regions. Each tell their own story, from Kohala to Hamakua to Hilo. So how do we tell these stories, these destinations? How do we bring them to life? So I think it's not just Hilo and Kona. I think it's about giving space for all 6 of the regions.
So I guess showcase more of the identity of those mm-hmm. districts.
Yep. One of the exciting things that's happening at our convention is I sent our team over, Kumuhina and others, to start laying the foundation, the groundwork, and they gathered the kumuhula from all of the 6 moku. So that'll be part of our convention, is the opening ceremony will include 32 kumuhula from all of the different regions of Hawaii Island. So it really, and that's not often that happens, where they come together like that. But that's how I think, if we're going to have space on Hawaii Island and we're going to start moving there, you kind of got to do it correctly. This is our effort to start uniting the community and bringing them together and identifying what their needs are, but also what opportunities they'd be open to, so that we could work with them on the future.
And then someone pointed out to me that for the first time, we've got Native Hawaiians at the helm of HDA, Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement, and HBCB.
How and DBED too.
And DBED, yes.
Jimmy's Hawaiian mm-hmm. too.
So how are you looking at that?
Well, I don't know that it was planned per se, but I think it is absolutely an amazing thing. I think, you know, like now that we have the baton, we have to make sure that we live up to that. So I'm excited about the future. Of course, there's politics intertwined in all of it, and that's the least exciting part of all of this. But I think Hawaiians have asked to be given a chance to lead, and now we got to lead.
That was Kuhia Lewis, Chief Executive Officer of the Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement. The convention will also feature a debate between the Big Island's mayoral candidates. Mayor Mitch Roth will face off with Kimo Alameda before the general election.
The world takes you outside your borders and connects you with the most important events happening all across this big blue marble.
We introduce you to memorable people whose stories will stay with you for a lifetime. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Global news and inspiring voices that will keep you on top of the world.
Listen each weekday.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Occupational Safety and Health, also known as HIOSH, committed to the people of Hawaii, working to help keep workplaces safe and protect employees' rights. More by searching HIOSH.
The recent mass shootings on Oahu's west side that left 4 people dead sent shockwaves across the state. It followed a string of other violent crimes that spurred community meetings, including one last night in Nanakuli. It featured Honolulu police as well as state law enforcement officials. HPR's Cassie Ordonio recently spent some time with Waianae residents to understand how they're dealing with violence. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, lots of attention. The law enforcement people are reaching out to the residents there because they don't like what they're seeing.
No, and they're totally on edge. In this community, I spent the past 2 weeks in Waianae, and several of the community members told me, you know, their community is close-knit, family-oriented, and scrappy, but with the recent acts of violence this past year, they said they've never seen the intensity like this before.
And you were just there and actually caught sight of something happening.
That's right. So on a recent Sunday, there was a slam poetry event, and I went to that because I wanted to kind of gather more sources, get more community voices into my story. And during this uncle who was giving a slam poetry piece, right behind him at the gas station, this was right outside T Presso off Farrington Highway, there was a man who was beating his, I think it was his girlfriend, but it was a woman, kicked her down, kicked her in the face. But the community responds, they are such on high alert. There was about maybe a dozen people at that slam poetry event. So immediately the uncle who was on the microphone turned around, said, stop the violence. He was ordering them to stop. But because he was on the microphone, he was loud enough to where it was gathering more attention to it. But immediately there was another woman. I think she went to Nunakuli High School. She was already on the phone calling 911, describing what was happening. But because those two, the couple saw that there was so much attention on them, they immediately got in the car and sped off, and everyone was trying to calm down.
Right, but still pretty shocking to witness.
But I did notice that the law enforcement response, it took about maybe 10, 15 minutes for at least one patrol cop to get there. And so looking at Waianae, I didn't realize how big the community was. So the Waianae coast, I know it stretches 13 miles from Nunakuli to Makua. So when you think about it, when I was talking to residents, they were saying, you know, there's some law enforcement, you see them more on the weekend than you see them during the weekday, but they have this huge stretch on the Farrington Highway just to get to one incident. So I did speak with Berna Lanford Bright. She's a 74-year-old who is a part of the Kapuna Council, and I told her about the recent violence that I witnessed at that recent Sunday, and she said, you know, it's domestic violence does happen behind closed doors, but it's not normal to see it in broad daylight.
Over here in Waianae, was very close-knitted. You cannot be abusing your wife. I don't care even if it's your wife. And family, take care of family. So what you doing, bro? Oh, my wife, she don't like listen. Well, come here, I slap your head so you know how I feel like when you slap in her head. You know, but it gets worse if you don't know each other. Okay, then you don't care. You're going to lick them. You're going to fight them. But if you know, oh, I know this brother. His body is related to me, so I go and talk to him and I give him only one chance. After that, that's it. He'll get it, you know. So we had, my dad had his little gangsters at that days in the 30s, the 25s and 30s, that would patrol and take care of people like us, the young, you know, that we make sure that we don't get hurt. And they were much worse than police, because you lucky you had two policemen on this coast, but they would take care of that, you know. So that would have never happened. I never did see that happen during my life growing up until this age. Which is recently that killing, that's terrible. That would have never ever happened should the old folks be still living.
She brought up an important point about, you know, there were actually uncles back in the day and aunties, older aunties, who would watch over the kids, making sure they weren't being rascals or getting into trouble. But you have people who had that role, but, you know, they passed. And talking to residents, there hasn't really been an influx of the younger generation assuming that role and watching over the younger generation to make sure that they're not getting into trouble or surrounding themselves with the right crowd. So talking with other community members, they're saying it's really up to the community, like the nonprofits, the church groups, the school groups, to really reach out to the younger generations, because there are some folks explaining that the issue of the recent violence is very complicated. Some people say there's a disconnect with the community where COVID happened, so there's not really this face-to-face exchange of stories, this passing down of cultural knowledge from the older generation, like the tutus.
Right, it's broken down. The system's broken down.
Yeah, and it's not really there anymore. At least that's what I've gathered from some of the community members that I interviewed for this story. And they were some of the residents were also saying that there's also lack of resources, but their community's response, they said it has to be much quicker than what they're getting from lawmakers or the Honolulu Police Department or DLNR. So I spoke with Georgette Stevens, and she's a part of the Waianae Hawaiian Civic Club. And she was the one who had to call for like more community meetings, especially after the shooting at Makua.
When there was a shooting at Makua earlier in the year, our community was like really frantic about what's going on with the gun violence. So we created a consortium of different organizations within our community, about 40 of them, that came together and just shared what it is that they do and what kind of resources they provide. And from that time to now, we've been trying to put together all of these resources so that we can get that information out to the broader community, so they know that, okay, I need help with this, and they can go to that resource. Because we're all volunteers, we haven't been able to really refine that structure, but we do have a website called whyandicares.org. And then subsequently, as recently as 2 weeks ago, we had, you know, that other town hall meeting, and that one was more focused with the Opio and the Keiki, to where what are their manao, and what do they want to see happen in our community to make us more whole and to live aloha. The bottom line with two of those processes that our community went through is we all agree that we have to aloha each other, and that we have to go back to our cultural roots, our identity, and Ka'ala Farm plays an important role in that, where they provide the Aina-based education along with other organizations in our community. You have Nakamakai that does the ocean. You have Hoa'aina Omakaha. You have so many different organizations that are here for our community. We just have to remind our community that we're here. These are the things that you can do for you, for your ohana.
Yeah, they care.
They do. And, you know, when we were talking earlier, too, and talking to other community members, is that Waianae has been stereotyped and gained a reputation of being the Wild West and yes, being scrappy. But talking to some of the folks, they're saying, like, sometimes, you know, if you talk mess, you fight it out, you forgive, and you move on. That's how it's supposed to be. It's never been, they were telling me, it's never been to the extent of taking someone's life. And so some of the folks said they kind of want the fights to come back and just do like a one-on-one and then squash it that way.
Yeah, interesting. But it's a totally different time that we live in, and the violence is just escalating, so that's not good.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you so much, Cassie.
Thank you.
We've been talking with HPR's Cassie Ordonio about her stories on the growing violence in the Waianae community. Saturday will mark World Peace Day, a United Nations-sanctioned holiday commemorating ideals of peace. This weekend, Honolulu's Iona Contemporary Dance Theater will observe the day with a performance featuring two new works and incorporating music from Bells and Bowls. Iona founder and artistic director Cheryl Flaherty and musician Brian Jordan sat down with the Conversations Lillian Song to talk about the healing and transformative power of music and dance. Flaherty starts us off.
Peace has always been an important aspect of my works, whether it's looking at women in domestic violence situations or the earth that needs to be healed and religious tolerance that needs to be accepted. And so I decided to choose this day to do two new works that surrounded the idea of peace. The first dance that we're doing with Brian, Resonance, lends the audience to that. And I think that the state of consciousness that the dancers are in evokes a feeling of peace within you. When the dancers first experimented with the idea behind Resonance, I was surprised myself at the feeling I had inside of me, which was extremely peaceful. And then the second dance that we're doing, which is called Breed, is really about the makings of peace versus violence in our community. So it's a little bit more of a heady intellectual number. And with Breed, I think I would want the audience to maybe think a little bit when they leave after seeing that piece.
And audiences who are familiar with Iona probably have been to the Hawaii Theater for your performances. This year, you guys are going into a new space.
Yes, we are thrilled to be at the new Pa'i Arts and Cultural Center in Kaka'ako, which is a beautiful new dance studio created by Vicky Takamine. And it's a different style of show. You know, when I was in New York creating my first works, we did studio performances. You didn't book a theater. And it's so lovely to have this kind of a venue in Hawaii so that you don't need to rent the big theater and all of the technicians and the lighting and all that. And that's all wonderful. But this is a very intimate experience for the audience and the dancers to be together and close. And the dancers are also playing instruments in this piece. They're playing a little Japanese furin, which is a wind bell. It's interesting, the first time that we rehearsed with Brian, I had the idea before we tried it. He played and the dancers improvised with their bells and it sounded really beautiful together.
On the bell itself, though, you have the word peace in Japanese, but for the production, what is going to be happening with those bells?
Well, each wind bell has a little paper tag that hangs down, so we have peace written in a different language on each bell, and the dancers got to choose their bells and their language based on their own personal ancestry. So that gives them a nice little connection to the piece. This one, actually, it's interesting, is really, really old. This is one of my first bells that I took maybe 25 years ago to Europe, and I rang it all over Europe. I danced in the Greek temple in Delphi with my bell. I rang it across the island of Iona, which is only 3 miles long. And that's where I first conceived this idea of the dancers playing these bells. And so this is a long time coming that I've been wanting them to work with the bells. Really requires more movement. This one is really a high-pitched bell. They have all different tones, surprisingly.
Okay, and so 12 dancers, 12 furin?
12 bells.
Okay, and so Brian, you have your bowls. Kind of talk us through what you're doing.
Okay, so there's two ways that you can play the bowls, primarily. There's striking the bowls, which is a little bit more of a percussive sound, which sounds like... And then if you... rub the mallet, it's like a silicone rubber mallet, around the outside of the bowl. It gives a very singing sound, so it's a very ethereal, meditative sound.
So some of the ideas behind this really come from watching the dancers with their bells, just straight on improvising. Like, and we train improvisationally. That comes from the Japanese buto dance that I studied in New York and then brought to Hawaii and the dancers too. And so out of watching the dancers, I came upon some ideas to give the piece some structure. And in the beginning of the piece, they're doing something I call catching spirits, where they're just seeing like a spirit hovering in the space and then taking it and then either releasing it into the space or putting it into their body or putting it into the earth. And that came upon another section called reincarnation, where they're walking, and this came straight from watching them improvise, where they're walking with another person. And then they move and walk with another person. And so it was about how we walk with different people through life, and then we change and walk with another person and walk with another person. There's times, Brian, in rehearsal where you're just totally still when you like stop playing, and I just know that you're in the same, you're like have become one of the dancers in that moment. Yeah.
Yeah. It feels like that sometimes as I'm playing, that it is a dance. As I'm playing the bowls, I find I get into my own kind of meditative state. It's always as though I'm not playing the bowls. It feels more like the bowls are playing me. And so there's this dance, if you will, that happens between me and the music. And it's almost like you can't distinguish between the two. And that connection just feels like peace to me. Mm-hmm. It feels like being in the moment, being just in this pure moment of existence. And that's the best way that I can explain it. It fills me with peace to play, and I feel.
And you're sharing that with.
Sharing that.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is that Brian is in the center of the stage, and so the bowls are vibrating out, and then the dancers are also participating in this vibration through their consciousness. So when you, as an audience member, pay attention to the dancer visually and emotionally, kinesthetically, and then you have the auditory and the vibration of the sound, it becomes all-encompassing.
So as we wrap, any final thoughts? Anything else you want to just leave our listeners with on a final note, Cheryl?
I would just say please support the arts and come out and see the show and have a wonderful live experience. It's wonderful to be able to be an artist and put together ideas that you have and to have them be abstract enough that the audience can take whatever they like from it. So I'm planting the seeds in these two dances. And there's a lot of ideas in there, definitely. I'm definitely a little bit intellectual with my work. But I keep it abstract enough that they can form their own opinion and have their own experience. That's really what I go for, is any kind of a shift that they might have, to me, is like a soul shift. And you walk away from that performance slightly different and slightly changed, you know? And for this particular show, I want the change to be around the idea of peace. And peace begins with us individually. So every person that walks out and has a little shift contributes to peace globally.
And that was Cheryl Flaherty and Brian Jordan talking with HPR's Lillian Song about the latest Iona concert, Dancing for Peace. And we're told audiences are in for a treat as a musician, Taimani Gardner, exchanges her ukulele for a Japanese furin bell to perform Iona style. There are said to be two shows daily, Friday and Saturday, at the Pa'i Arts and Cultural Center in Kaka'ako. Look for more details on our website after the show. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, the Hawaii Healthcare Association weighs in on the labor dispute playing out between Kapi'olani and the Hawaii Nurses Association. Share your comments or questions by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.